All right, I want to welcome everyone to today's webinar, Machine Learning for Business Users and Enterprise Developers, sponsored by our friends at Microsoft. And this should be an excellent discussion. I would say 2015 is shaping up to be the year of machine learning, but we want to go beyond the mere concepts of machine learning and really understand how it can be deployed, used, and even embedded in applications. My name is Andrew Brust. I'm the research director for big data and analytics at GigaOhm Research. And we have some distinguished panel members with us. I'll let them introduce themselves. We'll start with Paul Miller from the United Kingdom.
Hi, Andrew. As you said, my name is Paul Miller. I'm an analyst at the Cloud of Data here in the UK. And a member of GigaOhm's Analyst Research Network, mainly working on cloud and big data things.
Excellent. Let's move to Lynn Langett, please.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Langett. I'm a working big data and cloud architect, and I've done some work in this domain. So I think this is going to be a really great discussion today.
Excellent. And from our sponsor, Microsoft, we have Hiren Oberoi.
Hi, everyone. This is Hiren Oberoi, Director for Product Management, focused on our advanced analytics technologies and solution stack, and looking forward to the conversation.
Excellent. So let's just kind of go over a little bit of an agenda. The bullets you should hopefully see in front of you cover our main discussion points, but these are really just a framework for the discussion. We're going to talk about machine learning algorithms and the groupings of those algorithms, typical use cases for machine learning, some less, perhaps less obvious but still very valid use cases. The differences, we'll go into some definitions, the differences between data mining, machine learning, deep learning, predictive analytics, and then finally how to integrate machine learning functionality into line of business applications. Couple of housekeeping things. Before we start on those discussion points, I'll be turning it over to Hiren from Microsoft so that Hiren can tell us about what Microsoft is doing in the machine learning space. And there's an awful lot going on, and including an announced acquisition. Also, we'll have a couple of poll questions during the webinar. We'll be doing that specifically so we can get a sense of you, the audience, and it's also our sneaky way of getting a sense of kind of how things are shaping up in the market in terms of adoption and deployment. There is also a little panel in the GoToWebinar control panel where you can type questions, and I will do my best to keep an eye on those, and we'll see if we can just answer those on the fly as we go through them. If for some reason we end up with a bit of a deficit, a bit of a backlog, we do have the ability to have a Q&A section at the end of the talk. But we'll try and take them in turn. And I think that's about it for housekeeping. So at this point, I will turn it over to Hiren.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. So really just want to use a little bit of the time to provide some perspective on, you know, what we're seeing going on, what we hear from our customers, and our view on, you know, what's going on with both machine learning and advanced analytics. Now I'll start out just in terms of looking at some of the broader trends. The top two buckets really don't need that much explanation. I think it's been spoken about at length when you think about, you know, the availability of, you know, elastic compute at scale that's reliable, that opens up opportunities to do, you know, kinds of number crunching that before required, you know, intense amounts of hardware. The data explosion is another obvious one. I don't think we need to, you know, belabor that point. But the two ones underneath, I think, are really interesting in the context of this discussion. One is the sort of emerging data science talent. It's actually quite interesting to watch how many universities are starting out with data science programs. I mean, they started out as data science courses, and now you see data science diplomas. And even if you look at some of the online forums like Coursera, you know, I think I believe it's Andrew Ng's machine learning course, or the data science course, that's kind of like one of the most popular ones on Coursera. So just you know, as we look out 3 to 5 years, the number of people coming out of you know, educational institutions, as well as just kind of learning online, in terms of filling that data science gap, we start to see that really change. And then the last piece is really how we think about customer expectations from businesses. So a lot of the trends that we see, you know, you hear a lot about organizations saying, how can I leverage data as an asset? You know, how do I help drive competitive advantage for my business using data as an asset? And that's partly really driven by customer expectations in terms of, you know, what customers expect businesses to do. I'll use a simple example of you know, fraud or credit card fraud, and that's been a lot in the news these days. But, you know, if I'm using a credit card, I really do expect that if I'm making a transaction or if someone has made a fraudulent transaction on my behalf, that the systems, you know, at my credit card company will pick it up and I will be informed. That's just kind of a basic expectation. And so what organizations are expected to do for their customers in ways that are automated, you know, those expectations are really going much higher. And that's really driving a need for businesses to change and think about how they view data. So if we can jump to the next slide. Now, we'll get into this discussion, you know, in the conversation as well, but, you know, machine learning is in, from a technology standpoint, isn't really that new. You know, we used to call it data mining, and we'll talk more about that. But there have been, you know, what I'll call certain barriers to adoption, or, you know, certain things that have slowed down the adoption and use of this. From a lot of the customers we talk to, and we have a lot of enterprise customers that you know, run on SQL Server today and have data warehouses and transactional applications and do BI on it and all that. You know, when they look at advanced analytics projects, well, the first is, you know, the tools to actually do this are really expensive. You know, you're looking at $100,000 plus for user seats for very, very specialized tools. The second is that the tools themselves aren't all unified in the sense that if you look at a typical advanced analytics problem, I'll go back to the example of fraud detection. 80% of the work actually is in the data preparation, the data connectivity, the data integration, and those are separate set of tools. And then you get to the actual, you know, modeling and building your model, and that's another set of tools. And then that takes us to the next piece, which is the deployment complexity, which is once you've actually built out, you know, and trained and tested your analytics model, you now have to put this thing in production, and guess what? You now have to recode that in another language that will scale and that will run in my production environment. So, for example, I might build a model on my desktop using R, but when I want to actually put this thing in production, I need someone who knows Java or .NET to actually code something up in a distributed system in a distributed fashion. And the last one is sort of a little bit the opposite of the trend, which is while there's a trend of a lot of educational institutions producing, you know, newly minted data scientists, in organizations today, there's still very much a talent shortage. You know, every organization wants to do something around machine learning, and you start to see a lot of these open job postings for data scientists, and that means different things for different people. But there's a lot of organizations now saying we actually don't have the talent in-house, you know, which is a combination of understanding the math, understanding the programming, and understanding the business, and how do those things come together. So if, jump to the next slide, Andrew. So our perspective here is, you know, it's an extremely interesting time. There's a lot going on. We view it as a huge opportunity to help organizations and businesses make the most of the data they have. And the way we really want to enable this is through the notion of accessibility. And we think in order to make this accessible, there's really three core audiences you have to cater to. The first is the data scientists themselves. How do you make it easier for them not only to do the modeling part of it, but also to do the data preparation and the data integration part of it? And then how do you help them do it in the tools and the languages that they're familiar with? So if I'm an R person or a Python person, you know, I don't have to go learn a new tool or language. I'm just going to go build my model the way I've always built it. But then when it comes time to deploy, I don't have to go do a bunch of rework to do that. So Andrew mentioned sort of an acquisition earlier. Revolution Analytics is a company we've announced the intent to acquire, and we're excited about that. That's going to help us really, help our community plug in and accelerate some of their models and development over there. The second piece is the IT professionals. So this is the, hey, you just threw me an R package. I don't know how to run this thing in production. I now need to basically rewrite the algorithm in Java.NET. And how do you help me do that more effectively? And so, again, that's where, you know, having cloud-based deployment helps a lot, where you can actually bake that into the managed web, the managed service itself. And then the last piece is really about the ecosystem and developers. So if we really, really want to drive pervasiveness of machine learning, it's not, you know, just about the data scientists building models. It's going to be about the developers using the APIs that have the models behind the scenes to make the apps better. The most simplest example of this is the recommendation engine, where I may have, you know, a mobile application or a web application that's basically surfacing, online retail solutions, you know, and I want to show the next best recommended product. Well, I can build my own algorithms, or I can just plug into, you know, the best in class machine learning APIs that are out there, call it through REST, you know, RESTful web services, and then, you know, have my application be that much better. So, you know, the applications of this in terms of what it can do for application development are just really fascinating. You know, everything from speech recognition to language translation to image recognition to, you know, recommendations, like all those things now become available to developers who don't have to really understand machine learning in depth. They just need to know what are the inputs I can give it and what are the outputs that I get. So that's really the focus, and ultimately it's how do we take the, you know, help all three audiences drive accessibility of the use of this technology ultimately let organizations get more from data itself. So Andrew, if you just move forward. So before we jump into dialogue, I thought, you know, one of the things I wanted to kind of anchor back on was it's really less about the technology. The technology, of course, is really exciting, and we're doing a lot over there, but it's really about helping connect that back into the actual types of problems that customers and organizations are seeing. And you know, we've had a lot of conversations bottoms up with a lot of different customers, and we've kind of looked at some of the top-down trends as well. And it really kind of came down to four broad buckets, you know, the ones you see up here: sales and marketing, finance and risk, customer and channel, and operations and workforce. And within the context of these, you know, this is just a subset sampling that we saw come up most frequently, but there's just such a broad set of scenarios, you know, that organizations can look at and say, based on the information that I have, both internal and external to my organization, how can I use, you know, machine learning and some of these techniques to enable some of these new scenarios or make some of these existing scenarios better. So I won't go into this in depth because we're going to have that dialogue, but I just want to use that to then tee it up and hand it back to Andrew. So again, thanks everyone for your time. And if you're interested, you know, azure.com/ML is our machine learning portal where you can actually try out some of the tools for free.
Excellent. Thank you, Harain. And we'll go ahead and move on into the main part of the discussion. First, let's try and cover some concepts, and in order to get context, let's also get a sense of some of the use cases. So we're kind of breaking these down into typical use cases, and then right after this, some less obvious ones. We've listed various industries up there, and probably no reason to recite them. But Lynn, maybe you could share with us the most interesting kind of implementation of ML you've been involved with thus far in some of your consulting work. And if I'm assuming a little too much, then, you know, tell us about something that you'd like to go after that you know about.
No. I have one that I'm particularly, I think it's just a really, I don't know, just do good, be good. It's the effectiveness of cancer drugs. And it was productizing academic research. So that's really kind of the broader use case that I'm seeing with biomedical. So it was research that was, you know, done at a research university, and specifically in the use case, it was chromatographic analysis of white blood cells. And so the machine learning bit was, you know, the typical sort of the algorithms of machine learning. But what was really interesting was the chromatographic analysis. And that was new for me. You know, I'm used to working with, I guess I'd say, more traditional kinds of data, like text data, you know, numeric data, but ultimately gets translated, obviously, with the RGB values. But I'm seeing more of that. In fact, actually this week, I was up in LA working with a startup, and they're doing analysis of photographs off social media sites for the purposes of creating aggregations around groups of data. And again, chromographic analysis and geospatial analysis of the images in the photos. So the thing that's really been really interesting for me around ML, or as I call it, the new data mining, is the new kinds of data that I'm being able to work with in this paradigm across these different verticals. And I've done manufacturing, IoT, biomedical, and I guess pharma would be the ones that I've worked in.
Okay, excellent. Paul, how about what you're up to? We know a lot of what you're doing is, you know, more broadly focused on cloud, but how, if at all, has machine learning entered into some of your work?
I think machine learning, in all its various guises, which we'll dig into a bit in a moment, underpins a lot of what's going on in this space. You know, Haren talked about, you know, cloud and ubiquitous data being almost table stakes in this space. And I think increasingly that's true. And people are beginning to deploy a lot of machine learning techniques to actually get on and solve problems using their clouds and using the data that they have. And I was just sort of remembering earlier today an example from 20 years ago. I was doing a PhD at the time in archaeology, and a fellow student in the archaeology department was building a neural network using, at the time, pretty advanced machine learning techniques, which looked at photographs of sheep's teeth from excavations in cities around the UK. And they were using the photographs in the neural network to work out how old the sheep were, what sex they were, whether they had any diseases, and it was, you know, fascinating work. And that was 20 years ago. Now, of course, the tools are much easier, and it's probably the kind of thing that undergraduate students do instead of PhD students.
Well, that's an interesting segue, because actually, Haren and I have known each other for a while. In a prior life, I was CTO at a consulting firm that did custom development and BI work, and I was on an advisory council for BI at Microsoft. And we would have discussions then, because all of the projects we were doing in BI were focused on OLAP. And in those days, we really wanted to get into data mining, but it wasn't resonating to the degree, at least for our firm, that we wanted it to. Haren, maybe you could kind of comment. You know, Azure machine learning hasn't been live for that long. I guess it was this past summer, right? But how are things tracking and trending so far?
Yeah, no, I think Azure Machine Learning, it's still in preview. We're going to go live very soon, actually. We've had a lot of customers in the preview program. And you know, as I think back to data mining that we had in analysis services and now, you know, some of the, probably two of the biggest differences I see are, you know, one is just accessibility of the tool set. You know, you had to have an analysis services cube and set up an analysis services server, and then you could start to actually do something. You know, you actually need a server to do something on your desktop, which is kind of ridiculous if you think about it. Now, you know, if you want to get started, you go to a URL, you click on a button, and you're off. You know, you're off to the races. So that's the accessibility point. I go back to is sort of one, and then the other one is there's just a lot more people that are now becoming familiar with the concepts. You know, even and I think webinars like this help. Back then, you know, when you started to talk about, no one really even said machine learning, you just said data mining, but when you started to talk about, you know, classification and clustering, people's eyes glazed over, and now I find a lot more people are just educated on what these things mean, and that's driving a lot more thinking and using of the actual capabilities.
And we've listed some scenarios as well, predictive maintenance, customer intelligence, fraud. We have one client in this space, by the way, that specializes in fraud detection and prevention. And up till now, a lot of fraud prevention has been based on kind of a rule system where there were known patterns of fraud, and you kind of searched for that in the data. What these guys are doing, actually, is using machine learning to observe, through anomaly detection, new fraud patterns, so that the fraud detection system can be organic and can, you know, kind of keep up with the bad guys. Forecasting, actually, that worked well all the way 10 years ago. That was a pretty straightforward thing. As you said, though, Haren, you know, you needed to kind of get an analysis services server set up, and now with the cloud, you know, there's still a server involved, but it's Microsoft server. So all we need really is a browser. Let's move on and talk about some of these algorithms. And actually, Lynn, I'm going to come back to you because I know we've been chatting about this a little bit as we work on a report that will be out soon. That's also underwritten by Microsoft. Can you kind of navigate through the broad groupings of machine learning algorithms for us?
Sure. And this is really for the audience who's maybe completely new to ML. So if you're not new, you know, go grab a cup of coffee for a minute here. But I do encounter this in my consultancy, so we wanted to include this just to help people understand the landscape. So I start at the highest level with the difference between traditional analytics and predictive analytics, because not in all cases is machine learning or predictive or probabilistic analytics appropriate to solve the particular business or problem. And you can think of it in English as the likelihood. So you want to ask a business question where the result is, what is the likelihood of a particular outcome or a particular new member being a member of a set? And so, again, very, very simplified. So if you classically trained people in the audience, you know, forgive my oversimplification here, but trying to, you know, make the translation to the business people. So we have really three different high-level groupings of algorithms or formulas that we apply in machine learning. And the top level is what's called regression. And really what that means is the application of one or more algorithms. The most common is linear regression, where you're going to take a set of known values, and then you're going to put a new value in it and predict a associated result. Like a time-based prediction is another example of this. Over time, how many will we sell of this one thing? So that's an ML algorithm of type of regression. And that requires a known set of data, which is called supervised, because you don't just throw random data, you put a known set of correct. The second kind is classification. And what this is, and I would explain it with the photos. So you have photos of animals, and you have a set that are, you know, are dogs, and you have a set that you know are cats, and that you know are rabbits. And then you use the classification algorithm with this known set to take a new photo or group of photos and say, is this more likely to be a dog, more likely to be a cat, or more likely to be a rabbit? And again, it's likelihood. That's kind of a key point with ML versus traditional analytics, where it's a yes or no answer. And then the last type is clustering. And that's where you have no known data. You just have a group of data. Let's say you have the contents of people's shopping baskets at a supermarket. And you want to find out what appears to be correlated and make groupings. So you have no labels. You have no associations. You just want to see where there are associations in the data. And again, these are the kinds of problems that ML relates to, which is really important when you're considering an ML solution.
All right. So just to reiterate, it's the things in the parentheses here: regression, classification, and clustering. Those are the three broad groupings. And then within each of those categories, there are a number of different algorithms that can be selected. And then typically each of those algorithms has a number of parameters that can be tuned. And actually, one of the interesting things going on in machine learning is that some of that actual selection and parameter setting is becoming more automated. So it'll be interesting to see how mainstream those sorts of capabilities become. We do have a couple of questions in the queue. One was just a clarification on the relationship between GigaOM and Microsoft. The relationship is that we work together. Microsoft is one of many vendors in the industry that's a client of ours, and we're presenting this webinar together with them. The fact that Haran and I know each other from before is more of a coincidence than anything else. GigaOM has an events line of business, a research line of business, which is where we are, and also GigaOM.com, which is our tech news site. And another question around mineral processing and heavy chemical industries, is machine learning applicable to that? I'll just say something generally, which is that machine learning is applicable to almost all industries, especially the heavy ones. The heavier the industry, the more machinery is involved, and the more machinery is involved, the more maintenance is important to keeping production running. And it turns out that by using sensors on the equipment, predictive analytics can help warn of some kind of breakdown before it actually happens. I learned that a few years ago by talking to somebody at GE, and found out from that gentleman that they do a lot of this in their manufacturing line work. I imagine in oil and gas and chemical and mineral processing, the same would come in. I don't. If anyone else has anything to add to that, speak up.
I guess that's a good point, that you can certainly use it on the preventative maintenance, predictive maintenance. The other area in sort of the oil and gas space where machine learning is very important and being widely used is around prospecting, discovering new likely places to drill for oil, to drill for gas, to mine for particular minerals by looking at things like the geology, the shape of the landscape, and various other criteria, and comparing that to what you have, already from successful sites. That's certainly an area where it is being heavily used by some of the bigger oil and gas companies, for example.
Wow. All right. So I'm saying wow, not because of your answer, Paul, but because we have an awful lot of questions in the queue, which just shows, I think, how much, thirst for knowledge there is around this topic. In fact, actually, one of the questions is an answer. One of our attendees said there's something called Google for Bullet, open source physics engine, and its applicability in the mining industry. So I suppose that speaks to the prior question. And there's a few others. I'm going to keep moving on here, though, but I'll try and stitch these in, keep them coming. Like I said, we can do a Q&A session towards the end. We can also do a couple of them while people are voting in the polls. So a few more areas where machine learning is used that may not be quite as obvious. We've listed a few here. Do any of these, Hiren, resonate with you and any of the customers who have been using Azure Machine Learning while it's been in preview? I think the philanthropy one, perhaps.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think on the philanthropy side, we actually have a partner who's working with nonprofits to the partner themselves. What they do is they collect and curate external sources of data, so they have feeds into social media and news and things like that, and they offer a service to, in this case, to the nonprofit to actually help them kind of going back to prospecting, identifying which individuals are more likely to be donors, and so it helps them, target their fundraising campaigns and fundraisers more effectively. So it's kind of an interesting use case where, we're using the power of all this ephemeral data that's out there to actually profile individuals with the intent of, connecting the right causes to the right people. It's interesting. It's just a lot of times I find people who say they want to give back and they want to get involved, but they're not sure. There's so many organizations out there, and so this actually helps connect people's values to the right organizations and donors.
All right, and we've got a few more questions about use cases. Let's see. What machine learning use cases are most prevalent in the financial services space? Another person explains that he has a CRM system, and sometimes the data is dirty, and he's wondering if machine learning can be applied to the problem of data cleansing. I'm paraphrasing there, but I think I've got it right. And the third person asks, or first states, that social networks have a huge impact these days. Is machine learning applicable for social listening? Let's see. Paul, would you have some opinions on some of these? Financial services, CRM data cleansing, and social listening.
Financial services, definitely. Fraud detection, risk analysis, refining models to create financial instruments that steer very close to the edge, taking as much risk as possible, but not too much. And a lot of that comes down to very tightly defined machine learning algorithms that effectively evolve as market circumstances change. All the fuss, remember before the crash, we all got very excited about quants. they were all using machine learning essentially, and they still are. They've just got a little cleverer about it.
All right. And how about social listening and data cleansing? Actually, for data cleansing, I want to throw that over to Hiren, because Microsoft has this thing called data quality services, and I know there's a little bit of AI in there. Maybe you could explain how that has crossover here, if at all.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in the case of data cleansing, you know, it's about finding, it's actually, in some ways, think about it, it's really an anomaly detection problem. You know, it's about finding patterns in the data that says, hey, this data doesn't look like the rest of it, or this doesn't look right. And so, you know, either we replace it with the clean data, or we remove it because it just shouldn't be there in the first place. So, you know, being able to use effectively anomaly detection, and then actually, depending on the kind of data you're cleaning, also external sources to complement the data that you have. You know, that is, again, a machine learning problem.
And one of our attendees has commented, CRM data is dirty, is in all caps. So yes, that tends to be the case. And social listening, absolutely. Lynn, maybe you could give us a little more than my yes or no answer. How can social listening be implemented with machine learning?
Well, it's customer service. Is really what comes to it. And even more broadly, as we're having this discussion, because, you know, I've been working in data mining, and I'm very old school. You know, I started with the Microsoft data mining extensions when that original team, you know, wrote them. I was one of the first people to get the preview. And interestingly, my first customer for data mining, this was, 10 years ago, was philanthropic. It was my local Philharmonic, and I helped them identify their donor base. But what's so interesting in this space is I call it the democratization of machine learning. And really what that results in for our business audience is it's not an option at this point. It's part of working with data. And if you're not looking at how you can implement ML to be competitive, you should be worried because your competitors probably are. It's no longer vertical or industry specific. From the data types being processed to the sources, whether social, which was the actual question here, to you know, looking at even repositories and logs of your own data. I mean, when I start ML projects, one of the first things that I do is I talk to companies not about external data, because that's the most common question they ask me. I talk about their own data, and then I do talk about data quality. And I was actually an early user of DQS because I do see this need, like that person who commented said, to clean your own data first.
Data quality services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the bigger answer to this is machine learning is part of the data stack now. That's the big shift. And if you're not starting to look at where it can be injected into your use of your data, then you're not being competitive.
And we've got, it's hard to believe, we have about 8 more questions in the queue. It's going to be hard to exhaust all of them, but Hiren, there was one that asked if Azure ML is replacing analysis services data mining. I know that question has come up before. What's the official ruling on that?
I don't think of it so much as replacing. You know, they're really, I'll call it kind of, you know, two products built with, you know, different purposes in mind. You know, data, analysis services, data mining was capabilities that were part of analysis services to extend and add some data mining to an existing, you know, analysis services project. So, you know, if you're an analysis services user and you've invested in building, you know, multidimensional tabular cubes and you want to do data mining against the data that's in that, you know, those things are still available for you. But as we look at the way the market's evolving and, you know, the earlier trends that I spoke to about cloud and accessibility, really kind of a lot of our focus now is to say, how do we take this from being, you know, a feature of a product that was fairly narrow to something that really can enable, you know, many audiences and organizations effective.
Great. And just to speak to other things on the slides, the education bullet is about a use case that I know about where there's a firm that focuses on analytics for school districts for kindergarten through 12th grade as we classify our education system here in the U.S. And there's an element to that, there's a facet to that where some of the metrics that are being tracked can actually be used predictively to intervene in a case where academic challenges and failures might come up so that services can be offered to that student before such things take place. Likewise, in the homelessness category here, it's actually the case that certain metrics around the rental market and evictions can be used to identify people who may be on a track to becoming homeless and making them aware of services that allow them to stay in their homes can be brought to bear, again, before an eviction takes place when, as I understand it, it's really a minimum of almost 2 years before, in a best case, before people who are in the shelter system can get back into an apartment. Political campaigns can use it to understand, you know, where their get out the vote is most desperately needed or would be most effective. And in philanthropy, foundations can actually use machine learning to, you know, kind of optimize their search for contributors, for the philanthropic services and awards that they bring to bear later. So now we're up to our first poll question. And again, while people are voting on this one, we might go ahead and try and answer another question or two. I'll launch the poll in a minute. But first, just to kind of read it out, what kind of analytics are you doing now? And this is not a single choice. You can select any that apply. We put spreadsheet work in there because we know that's where a lot of folks do lots of number crunching, and number crunching really is analytics. Data warehousing, OLAP, and more conventional business intelligence, so-called big data, including Hadoop, and then machine learning itself. So with that little narration, I will go ahead and launch the poll. We'll ask people to vote in. I'm going to read a couple of the questions out while this is happening. One person names an algorithm called ARIMA, and that's in all caps, ARIMA. I have to admit, I've not heard of ARIMA. The question is that included in machine learning algorithms? I don't know. Maybe that question is specific to Azure ML, if Azure ML implements it. So I don't know if anyone has. Go for it.
Yeah, I can take that. That's a common time-based algorithm, so time forecasting. And I assume that that's, I believe that's an Azure ML, you can confirm that, but that's a standard algorithm. It was in the data mining algorithms. I know in the Microsoft stack before there was ARIMA, and then there was the other time-based algorithm, you could do a blend. So it's a common in terms of time series algorithms, so I assume so.
All right, fair enough. And let's see,
a regressive integrated moving average, Wikipedia tells me, ARIMA.
You're looking it up on Wikipedia. No fair. That's cheating. Harain, do you know offhand if Azure ML supports that particular algorithm? Of course, you have.
Offhand, I don't. I mean, we have a broad set of regression algorithms in there, but I don't know if this specific one is, you know, one that we explicitly have. But I can look it up real quick.
That's a good segue, though. Maybe you can tell us about sort of the interaction you have with models that were already built in R?
Yeah, so one of the things, we realized early on was important was a lot of the, statistics community was basically doing their work in R, and what they didn't want to do was have to rework when they came to Azure ML, and so what we allowed you to do today is basically take your R code and, you know, plug it into the machine learning studio, so you can just take your R module and plug it in and not have to rewrite things. Moving forward, you know, with the acquisition, we're going to do more in terms of making the tooling better, making the debugging better, and then even, one of the big constraints of R today is it's basically, you know, runs in memory, so people run it on the desktop, but the minute you start working against large data sets, you know, it runs out of gas pretty quick. And so how do you take your work in R and then run it on large scale data? And so, you know, a lot of what the value of what Revolution Analytics had done was run R in this kind of scale out mode on, you know, platforms like Hadoop, as well as MPP data warehousing architecture. So those are kind of some of the things we'll start to do as we close out the acquisition and then move forward.
Very good. Glenn, you can comment. I'm just going to say I'm going to close the poll and put the results up in the background here because it's been open for 3 minutes. But having said that, please go ahead.
Okay, so I'm, you know, the big nerd that I am. I actually looked up my time series forecasting sample on ML, which I could do because it's all online. And the way that it works for the ARIMA right now is you use an R script. So it's okay. it's not a native algorithm, but because of the support of R scripting, and they have it in the reference samples. So if the person who was asking just wants to go and look it up, it's available.
Great, great. And of course, that's important. There's so much community behind R that having that extensibility there means that you really don't hit walls or ceilings, which is quite nice. So hopefully you can all see the results. I have to take that on faith. Actually, as the presenter, I don't see it on my screen, but we're seeing a big number for spreadsheet work. No surprise there. A very big number for OLAP and machine learning and data warehousing actually very close together, almost a tie for third place there. 39% on data warehousing, 37% already on machine learning. Again, I say this all the time, but if we're doing a webinar about machine learning, we should probably expect that we'll have a disproportionate number of folks who are actually using it. It tends to be a self-selected group, but obviously lots of people are here because they're not using it yet. So that's still a good number. And big data is actually behind machine learning, 28% for big data, including Hadoop, 37% for machine learning. Paul, any surprises here, or did you have different expectations? Next time, by the way, I'm going to ask you before I show the results what your expectations are, but since I didn't do that, you can lie.
I think the big surprise to me is that only 62% are doing spreadsheet work.
yeah, well, not everyone may be answering, honestly. it's one of those challenge questions. But how about machine learning ahead of big data? That one surprises me, I'll be honest.
I think partly that's probably, as you just said, you know, down to the self-selecting nature of the audience. I think you're still at a stage where the people within an organization who are perhaps using machine learning in anger aren't the same people who are down in the guts of their Hadoop cluster. So I'm not that surprised.
All right, fair enough.
Done some of the product management work for the Hadoop stuff earlier, in some ways I actually think machine learning is more accessible than the Hadoop, and even the concepts in machine learning are kind of easier to pick up than some of the concepts in Hadoop. So maybe that doesn't surprise me as much.
I would have said the same thing 10 years ago versus OLAP, but it worked out the other way. But I think factors are different now, and I forget if it was Paul or Lynn who spoke to this, but there's better awareness and literacy around broad machine learning concepts, and I think that creates a friendlier market. We're going to move on in the discussion now from just, you know, definitions to talk about some of the nuts and bolts of actually putting this stuff into play. And as we do that, I know I said, you know, we're moving away from definitions. That we will be hitting some definitions here, but we also want to kind of talk about the pragmatic side of this, which is which of these to use, not just understanding the difference. So data mining versus machine learning, we've kind of commented on that already, that in large part they covered the same things, but the data mining term is simply a little bit more dated. That said, they're probably not exactly the same if we got a consensus definition. Deep learning is a phrase that has entered the market recently. And then, of course, there's predictive analytics, and some people use that interchangeably with machine learning, some people not so. Lynn, I think I'm crowning you our definitions person on this webinar, and maybe you could help first sort out the difference between predictive and ML.
Yeah. So again, ML is a subset of predictive analytics, because sometimes you have, in the different suites, this will sometimes fall in, like in Azure ML it does, where you have descriptive statistics, which isn't, I wouldn't really call that ML per se. It's just application of stats, so analyze the data, mean, median, all that stuff. So predictive is a superset of ML, if you will. And then going down the slide here, ML is, like we were saying, specific observations that are probabilistic in nature that use either regression, classification, or clustering. And deep learning is a type, an implementation of, it's actually the neural net algorithm. It's a type of algorithmic implementation. And to put that in English, it allows more human-like complex analysis of very large data sets. This comes out of research that was done at Google, and it was analyzing what are the most common images on YouTube, among other data sources. And it's kind of funny, they spend millions and millions to find it was a face and a cat. But that sounds very, like, not useful at all, but the applicability of it is the neural nets algorithm for many years was not usable in certain domains because it had a sort of magic aspect to it. Without getting too mathy here, the deep learning implementation or improvement of it allows this most advanced ML algorithm to be applied in cases that it couldn't, biomedical, things like that, where you had to do the path through. Another implementation that we all see is around voice. So whether you use Siri or Cortana or Google Now, we're all starting to use voice inputs, which are getting increasingly good because of the application of these advanced algorithms. Another one is IBM Watson that won Jeopardy. So they're solving more human-like problems would be kind of the highest level explanation of deep learning, which, you know, makes ML more compelling for even more business scenarios.
Okay. And Paul, we saw how many people said they're doing OLAP work. So, you know, we could put that under BI pretty fairly. How adjacent is machine learning to that kind of BI? So maybe you could kind of help us not only distinguish between the two, but give us a sense of, you know, if we've successfully implemented BI, how accessible is ML to us as a next step?
I think it probably depends how you're defining BI to begin with. If it's simple dashboards and simple graphs from simple numeric data, ML is perhaps quite a large step away. Not an unachievable step, but quite a large step. However, if you're doing some of the richer BI analyses that a lot of today's BI tools let you do, then you're probably actually already doing machine learning. You might not know it.
And Haran, maybe you have a point or two to add to that. By the way, I'm guilty of my own accused crime here, but BI stands for business intelligence, just in case anyone in the audience isn't familiar with that two-letter acronym. Haran, what's your take on people moving, you know, from a BI implementation and starting to adopt ML? How is that going, if you have a sense of it?
Yeah, no, I think it depends on the use case, but I think in many use cases it is a natural progression. I actually have an interesting story. We here at Microsoft have what we call the cybercrime unit. It's a really cool unit, and their job is to do a couple of things. One is fight, you know, cybercrime in terms of internet attacks and hacks and things like that. Not specific to Microsoft, in general, because it does, you know, at the end of the day, impact the business. And then the other part of their job is to kind of look at fraud prevention, so counterfeit, counterfeit licenses and things like that. But interestingly enough, I learned is oftentimes run by organized crime and real mafia and things like that. But they were actually, they have this really great BI outfit, and they have these great visualizations that help them plot and look at, you know, anomalies and where they might be counterfeit. And the first time we met with them, you know, these guys are really, their background is really in sort of investigation, and some of these guys are like ex-FBI agents and stuff like that. They're really not technologists. But when we met with them, the obvious question was, wow, you guys are doing this manually. You know, why aren't you using machine learning? And then we kind of had to go through and educate them on what that meant and how they could do it. And then they realized that, you know, once they kind of figured out some of the patterns, they could start to automate these things and be a lot more effective in terms of how they identify anomalies moving forward. And so they've gone from, you know, having a really state-of-the-art BI system to now adding machine learning to it. And it's made just the whole operation a whole lot more efficient. So I think the automation part oftentimes goes unnoticed in terms of the key, you know, one of the key differences in how, you know, you don't have to have a person looking at a chart or a graph to make the decision. You're sort of making it on the fly, or at least making a recommendation on the fly, and then you have someone act on it.
Fair enough. And by the way, we have a comment from one attendee. And, you know, for privacy purposes, I'm not going to expose his name, but I know him to be a domain expert here, so I'm going to take his comment as authoritative. As far as I know, deep learning is the same as neural nets with more hidden layers. So I'm giving that a little bit of an endorsement since I happen to know who said it. Let's move on to our second and final poll. We still have some discussion after this. With 8 minutes left, that'll be tricky, but we'll do our best. What are you using for machine learning work? To show my age, every time I see ML, I want to say machine language. But machine learning, select all that apply, R or Python programming, Apache Hadoop with Apache Mahout, Sparks ML Lib, machine learning library, desktop data mining, machine learning product, or a cloud-based ML service. And of course, if you're not doing machine learning yet, that's okay, but then none of these would apply. I'm launching the poll, and we'll ask people to cast their votes. And we have even more questions in the queue. One person asks something that's perhaps a little bit in the realm of science fiction, but I feel like maybe we're getting closer to it. I'm going to throw this one to Paul because I'm just mean that way. Can the machine self-teach? You have some thoughts on that, Paul? And not only that, do you have thoughts on, you know, societal ramifications? It's okay to say no, but I'm just curious.
Within certain bounded context, yes. Machine learning is about a machine self-teaching or self-learning. It's looking at data and it's learning where the patterns are. It's identifying those patterns, applying them to its models, and then improving the model. So within bounds, yes, it is self-teaching. It's not, you know, going to be Skynet or HAL or anything like that, but yes, the machine is improving its own models without human intervention.
Right. Let's see. How long have we had the voting open? I'm going to leave it open for about 10 more seconds. Some interesting results coming up here. Lynn, you want to take a guess as to how many are using R or Python? Let's see how close we come to your predictive analytics on R or Python.
Given the audience is 35% ML self-stated, I would think that it would be artificially high compared to my general population. So if they're consistent in their answers, then that would be the majority of the people, I would say.
All right. Not quite a majority, but a rather large number. You should see the results shortly on your screens. So we've got 44% doing the programming language approach with R or Python. Very interesting that the Hadoop side of this, whether it be Mahout or MLlib, and again, MLlib is not technically dependent on Hadoop, but very often Spark runs on top of Hadoop, 11% and 9% respectively, 30% doing desktop data mining, and 24% doing cloud-based ML. Haran, any reactions to this?
You know, this was actually, I was going through it in my head before the polls came up, and it's actually right in line with what I would have expected. So, you know, makes sense, R and Python up there, followed by desktop, followed by cloud, and then Hadoop and Spark. It's actually right in line with what I would have expected.
Fair enough. I'm going to hide the results. I'm going to take us to our last slide. We've got, whoops. Our last slide is not Q&A, but how to integrate machine learning functionality into line of business applications. What skill sets and programming languages are required, and what domain expertise is required of a developer who's interested in putting this kind of functionality in his app or in her app? Lynn, tell me. Tell us.
Well, you know, things that expose a REST endpoint are going to have the highest adoption because developers, even mean stack or, you know, modern web developers generally are not experts in R or, you know, SciPy and NumPy. So that's going to give your best integration capability. And you see the vendors, including, you know, our host here, our sponsor, moving towards that because, you know, if you have to be an expert in R and also write the HTML5 phone app, it's not happening. So, you know, the functionality for ML needs to be exposed to these common interfaces, and that's where I see the market moving, which is a welcome change, and I think it's really going to increase adoption.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that you can write a function call in your code and get back a return value that is, in fact, a prediction seems pretty compelling. Haran, are you guys able to kind of meter the usage of the REST API calls? And if so, are any broad observations something you're comfortable sharing with us about it?
I think just to answer your question first, you know, when I think about developers and what do they need to know, or what's the biggest skill set they need to develop to use machine learning, what comes to mind for me really is imagination. Because at the end of the day, it's a function call for them, and the more they understand the applicability of, you know, what machine learning can do, that's how much they can make the application more interesting. They really don't need to know, you know, Arima and what these different models do. They just need to know that there's an API call that I can make. It's going to give me back the result that I want. But then to kind of answer the second question, yes, we do meter. What we expect really is we want, if you think about, you know, this as authoring, there's data scientists that author models and understand the science behind it. And then there's developers that consume it, both in apps and in other ways. The authoring really, you know, we want anyone to be able to author easily. And then the consumption is really where value is added. And so that's the thing that we'll meter really is the consumption of API calls, because that's when, you know, an individual or app or organization gets value out of the machine learning service.
One question here, not of a technical nature, but it's important. I bet a lot of people have it. Is whether this webinar will be posted online in recorded form and on-demand form, and yes, it will. This particular person missed the beginning of the webinar. I will go out on a limb here and say, even if you didn't miss the beginning, we've had a rich enough discussion here where you might well be interested in just hearing it again. And I don't know if it's a success or a failure that we still have more questions in the queue than I can really count. Does anyone have any examples of ML being used in the travel or hospitality fields? That was one question among many still in the queue. Haran, maybe you've come across that, or Lynn.
I mean, the most obvious one is airline price predictions. you know, that's one that comes to mind immediately. But, sure. Of course, you know, hospitality in terms of loyalty programs, I'm sure there's a lot that organizations can do in terms of, you know, predicting customer preferences and making offers associated with that.
All right. Well,
I mean, the big disruptor there is Airbnb, obviously.
Sure.
So, and they're presenting you with you might like all the time, based on what your pattern is. So.
Right, and hospitality companies themselves could use it to kind of predict utilization and set prices algorithmically. We could go on for 2 hours, but unfortunately we're only allocated a single hour. Here's a some photos of your panelists again. We enjoyed covering this with you, even if we've only scratched the surface. And again, this will be posted online. We thank you very much for your attendance, and hope you got something.